This episode, Once Upon a Detective Chimp. Hello, and welcome to the Once Upon a Geek podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On today's episode, we are finding our joy by celebrating the grand tradition of apes in comic books. We're specifically discussing a fun Detective Chimp story. It's also kind of a Dr. Fate story. My name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but thankfully, I am not doing this alone. For this episode, I'm joined by an old buddy of mine going back to my blogging days. I had to do the math. We've been working on projects together for 15 years, which is insane. And with that knowledge, I knew exactly who should help me monkey around talking about Detective Chimp. Folks, please help me welcome to the show Mr. Doug Zawisha. Doug, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing all right, Shag. How are you, my friend?
Fine. 15 years, 15 man.
15 years. Wow. 6 more years and we can drink.
That's right. You were doing, Doom Patrol blogs. You might have been doing Red Tornado blogs at that time. I don't remember.
No one remembers the Red Tornado blog.
I do. It was like Old Thune or something.
Old Thune, yep.
Yeah, look at that.
The Tornado Tyrant.
Well, I am so glad that you are joining me here. You actually came to me and said you wanted to talk about apes. And I was very thrilled. And I said, I got the perfect thing because we are part of JL Ape this year, which is JLA April 2024 podcast event. In the past years, we've always celebrated in May. But this year, our theme is apes, as you get it. You know, JL Ape roll. It's not a hard joke to follow, folks. Anyway, a whole bunch of different podcasters are joining forces to celebrate apes in comic books. Now, sir, are you a fan of apes in comic books?
Hell yes. I am definitely a fan of apes in comic books, and I believe the theory that I believe it was attributed to Julius Schwartz that if there's an ape on the cover of a comic book, it's going to sell more.
I believe that is correct.
It's going to sell at least one more copy to me. I know that much for sure.
So you're a sucker. Just you see an ape and you got to buy it, huh?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But the challenge is, though, is getting that ape right, because there are some folks who really nail it, like Arthur Adams.
Oh, yeah. Apes. Sure.
Carmen Infantino. I know he's kind of one of the legends, but not a great gorilla. I'm sorry.
So you're saying those Gorilla Grodd issues in the mid-80s that he did in the late Flash run weren't spot-on models?
I'm saying they're kind of painful for me. They might be great for other folks, but, you know, to each their own. We all went through our Kirby phases at some point, right?
Well, and Carmine, especially again in the mid-80s, like I see that as like an art form of its own. Like you just kind of have to accept it as this is what Carmine was doing, and that's okay.
Yeah, very much so. Kind of like Pete Townsend's Lifehouse, and nobody else really knows what's going on except what was in Carmine's head.
Well, folks, we are here to talk about Detective Chimp. Yes, we are here to talk about Bobo T. Chimpanzee. I can't even say it. Bobo T. Chimpanzee. What the heck is the T? I hope it's Tiberius. I don't know. But that's
I think it's the.
Oh, Bobo the Chimpanzee. Oh, my God. That's amazing. Well, I'm going to give a little quick history on him, and then let's talk about our own personal history with him. So his first appearance goes all the way back to 1952, which is crazy, in the back of Adventures of Rex the Wonder Dog, which everyone loves Rex. So issue number 4, being 1952, is created by John Broome, and who was the artistic creator?
Carmine Infantino. Put it together, ladies and gentlemen, for Carmine.
There it is. So, right. So he appears in Rex number 4, right? And he continues as a backup feature until 1959. He's there for like 45 issues, which is crazy. But, you know, kids love comics back then. Then absolutely. 1959 comes and goes, and he's pretty much gone. Just like gone into obscurity, you know. He gets a couple of cameos here and there. The most noticeable ones were like in 1981, the DC Comics Presents was doing those backups, you know, whatever happened to. And they did one on Rex the Wonder Dog and put Bobo in there. And in fact, that's the first time we ever found out about the whole Fountain of Youth thing. Then in 1985, he has like a little bit in Crisis on Infinite Earths. Then he shows up in Who's Who. I guess a half page entry, I'm pretty sure it was, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's sharing it with Despero, isn't he?
Oh, gosh. I don't remember who he shares it with. Yeah, I mean, it's Bobo. I didn't notice anyone else on the page. and then after that, real minor appearances. He's like in DC Challenge, which everybody loves, right?
No.
he shows up in a couple of Mark Waid Flash issues, stuff like that. And then the moment where he became an ongoing concern was in 2005 in the lead up to Infinite Crisis in that Day of Vengeance miniseries. He shows up as this hard-boiled private investigator. He's an alcoholic. I mean, he's, you know, smoking in a bar. And everyone immediately fell in love with him. And he went from there into Shadow Pack. And then he's been in Justice League Dark since like 2018. And it's just everywhere nowadays. And nowadays, and I didn't even know this, I had to look this up. He's carrying a sword now because Nightmaster died and left the Oblivion Bar to Bobo. So that's all stuff from Shadow Pack, leftovers. And then he's appeared on TV. He's been on Batman Brave and the Bold, Teen Titans Go. He's been in a bunch of video games. He's pretty much I don't want to say a household name, but he is a staple of the DC universe nowadays. So I should also, I didn't really give his origin. I should go through that real quick. So when he's first introduced, and this is a little bit of a difference. You know, Detective Chimp, he was like an ordinary, you know, he's intelligent, but he's a trained chimpanzee. And he was like a mascot to the local sheriff. And he couldn't speak, but he could understand humans. He could kind of make people sure he understood him. And he helped solve crimes. And that's what he did all through Rex. Then his origin gets revamped and elaborated on several times, actually, since the Silver Age. There's aliens in one of them, which is crazy. Anyway, most recently, they say basically Bobo is from Gorilla City and he was captured for a carnival act. And then later, Bobo and Rex go to Florida's Fountain of Youth. He gains the ability to speak to all living creatures, even humans, in their own language, as well as eternal youth. Which, by the way, as a Floridian myself, the Fountain of Youth is wonderful for that sort of stuff. So I got to ask you, Doug. So, like, what's your history with Bobo here? Like, you know, how did you find the character? How did you fall in love with him? Like, what's your deal?
Yeah, absolutely. And Shag, I was telling you this before we started going, I don't know where it really came into my consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, for sure from Who's Who, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody our age had that Who's Who and probably read their copies to pieces.
Yes.
But it sure feels like I saw more of him somewhere other than what you just went through. And I can't really pin it down other than I feel like it was Crisis, but I went and looked through my Crisis hardcover and it feels like he's only in a couple panels in there. Yep. Maybe one early, one late, nothing significant. So I did some more digging and there's that Flash Green Lantern crossover from the 90s, mm-hmm. Which was partially written by Mark Waid that featured a Hector Hammond team up with Grodd.
Yeah.
But Bobo wasn't really much of a detective in there. He was more kind of the chimpanzee version of a gigolo. Just kind of hanging out and being admired by the chick apes, I guess. And then Day of Vengeance, for sure.
Right.
And from Day of Vengeance, this comic, but like I said, it feels like he's been more prominent, but I can't tell you where. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, it's funny because like it feels like, okay, Day of Vengeance, fairly recent sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
Actually, it's almost 20 years old. It's almost 20 years old next year, which is insane.
That is insane.
To think that. So, I mean, when we were kids in the 80s, you know, the Justice League were only 20 years old and they were a mainstay. So, I mean, 20 years is a long time, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
So wait a minute.
Yeah.
You said Day of Vengeance is 20 years old next year.
Well, it might have been this year. Was it 2004 or 2005 when it was published? I don't remember.
I don't know, but that means 52 is going to be that old, too.
That's just criminal. That is criminal.
How did we stay so young? We were there with Bobo and Rex when they found the Fountain of Youth.
I told you, I live in Florida. It's right around the corner.
Yep. And that's why it feels so familiar.
So my story is almost identical to yours, man. It's Who's Who. I vaguely remember the DC Comics Present story, but I was probably more focused on Rex because I was obsessed with Rex because of his Who's Who entry. I, like, to me, Rex was a big deal. I didn't realize he was a footnote in history, but I thought Rex was a big deal. And when he showed up in Flash, I like lost my mind because, you know, like that's the end of the issue. It's like, you know, he shows up and he's like, he's talking to Flash. He's like, hi, I mean, my name is Rex. I'm here to help. And I'm like, oh my God, it's Rex. Hi. You know, no one knew who Rex was except for me because of Who's Who. Anyway.
Right, right.
So yeah, just like everyone else, I read Day of Vengeance and Shadow Pack and fell in love with him. And I have spent a little more time with him in podcasting form because I've podcasted about Shadow Pack a couple of times. We did a whole episode on the backup story with Rex and Wonder Dog and Detective Chimp and Rob did a bunch of Monkey Noises, which we kept playing episode after episode. So I feel like I've spent a lot of time with him, but you're right. It's like until 2005, he wasn't really anyone on my radar that much at all.
That's crazy.
Well, I'm glad Bobo's part of our life now.
Absolutely.
Well, before we get too much further, Doug, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of Once Upon a Geek is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for comic book trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Each episode will select a comic book collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStock Trades library, and it's usually tied into our discussion in some way, shape, or form. And my crystal ball is telling me that I think your pick's going to be pretty dead on, Doug. So what'd you pick for this InStock Trades?
I picked the Detective Chimp Casebook, which is a lovely hardcover from InStock Trades. Writers include John Broom and the Ultimate Various. Carmen Infantino on art, Brian Boland cover. And it says that Bruce Wayne isn't the only sleuth who knows how to swing across Gotham. Detective Chimp collects Amazing World of DC Comics number 1, DC Comics Presents 35, DC Special 1, Tarzan, 231, 234, and 35, The Adventures of Rex the Wonder Dog 4 and 6 through 46, and The Who's Who Definitive Directory of the DC Universe number 6. All of that, 280 pages, hardcover, in stock trades price $17.39.
Wow, that is a heck of a deal. That's crazy.
Absolutely.
So the thing that cracks me up the most about that book is the cover. It's an amazing cover taken directly from this comic we're going to cover today, Helmet of Fate, Detective Chimp. And that comic's not even included in the collection.
You know, I didn't even notice that.
But to be fair, if you've got Brian Boland drawing Detective Chimp, you're going to use that art, right? I mean, come on.
Absolutely.
Well, I picked Justice League Dark, The Great Wickedness, trade paperback. This collects Justice League Dark, the backup stories, which were in Justice League at the time, 59 through 71, and Justice League Dark, 2021 annual. So this covers the surviving members of Justice League Dark, you know, like Zatanna and John Constantine, and also Detective Chimp and several other people. And they're dealing with a Merlin plot and a lot of different things going on. But again, it was a backup in Justice League, pulls in Ragman into the story, kind of got Justice League Dark off and running again. Writers are Dan Waters and Ram V. Artists, got a few different ones. I'm probably going to say all these names wrong, so forgive me. Sumit Kumar, Harmonico, and Christopher Mitten. Cover arts by Paul Renaud. Page count's 184 pages. Full color, soft cover. Normally goes for $16.99, but you can get it for $9.85. That is dirt cheap. 42% for 184 pages. And again, it's Justice League Dark. It's all those characters you enjoy. It's kind of the darker, seedier, supernaturally side of the DC universe. And you know you love these characters. So it's definitely worth $9.85. It's a pittance, people. It's a pittance.
Absolutely. And it's The Great Wickedness. That just sounds like something you'd find up in Boston.
You read it next time you're in Boston. It's exactly right. For this and all your other comic book trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. All right, folks, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Fire & Water Network, you know, with so many shows, it requires a lot of online hosting and other services, and we got to pay Detective Chimp's bar bill. I mean, there's a lot that goes on here. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses, so we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying shows on the network, the best way to support us is by visiting patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network, and at certain tiers, you get mentioned on your favorite shows. This episode, special thanks go out to Michael Salko, Gord Tolton, and David A. Gutierrez. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcasts. All right, now, folks, as I always say, this isn't my show. This isn't Doug's show. Okay, it's certainly not Doug's show. But anyway,
no.
this is our show, right? This is about our entire geeky community, and you know you love Detective Chimp, because everyone does. For the last 20 years, we all have. So I want you to go on the socials, tell us your thoughts on Detective Chimp, talk about apes and comics, talk about, you know, JL Ape 2024, even Dr. Fate, you know, whatever. The best way to be part of the conversation is on our website, though. So just visit fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek, and you can leave your thoughts on the show post for this episode. In fact, that is the place you want to leave your thoughts if you want them read on the air. As I mentioned, the other socials, you can hit us up on Twitter and Blue Sky as Once Upon a Geek, or on Facebook and Instagram as Once Upon a Geek Podcast. But if you share your thoughts on the website, like I mentioned, I will be reading portions of your feedback on every fifth episode of Once Upon a Geek. And in case you're not keeping track, that's what I do for you. This is the 20th episode of Once Upon a Geek, so a little later, once Doug finally starts shutting up, I'm going to read your feedback from the past few episodes.
Awesome.
We shut up, Doug. Jeez, all you're doing is talking.
So much talking.
So, Doug, I am so glad you're here to be part of this big crossover event. Have you ever familiar with it all, our JL May and JL April stuff we've done before?
Absolutely. I think I may have popped in on one or two of them, and I've certainly listened to almost all of them.
Awesome. Well, it's a tradition going all the way back to 2016, where a bunch of podcasters get together, we pick a topic, and we all podcast on that topic in the month. So in 2016, we did JLA Year One, which was phenomenal. 2017, we did Alex Ross's Justice. 2018, we did The Silver Age. Okay, maybe not everything is great. 2019, we did Blackest Night. 2020, we did Countdown to Infinite Crisis. 2021, we did a little sidestep. We did a Marvel side of it. We did Merry Marvel Marching Society instead, covering Acts of Vengeance. Then we skipped a year because we're lazy. Then in 2023, last year we did the Brave and the Bold series from 2007 to 2010. And this year we are doing JL Ape Roll. Get it? Again, Ape Roll.
Man.
Dude, so, all right, there's a lot of podcasty friends involved in this thing. And a few of the brave souls are actually covering, and this is immediately where my brain goes, they're actually covering that 1999 storyline that was in the Justice League Annuals, JL Ape Guerrilla Warfare. Those poor souls. Like our folks over at the Bat Pod are covering Batman Annual number 23.
Quick side note on that one. I see that they have a new edition of the JLA trade paperback. I saw that on in-stock trades when I was looking for my recommendation.
Seriously? And noticed
that was not my recommendation. Also covering that is Dial F for Flanger, Aquaman Annual 5, and also Martian Manhunter Annual number 2.
He's taking a double dose of ouch.
A double dose and a double deuce, man. Jeez.
Oh. Well, the rest of us more sane folks are simply covering comic books featuring ape characters, such as Coffee and Comics is covering Wonder Woman number 170.
Quarter Bin Podcast is going with Kong on the Planet of the Apes number 1. I've got to find that.
It sounds fun. Married with Content with John and Maggie are covering JLA versus Kong versus Godzilla, which is so cool they did that.
Jeez, and the Outcasters, they're coming back a little bit more normal and going Angel and the Ape 1-4 with some great Phil Foglio art.
Yeah, it is. I remember that one. I was in the stores when that was going on. The Fanholes Podcast is covering the Kong Gorilla miniseries from 92 to 93, all four issues.
And the Campus Comics Cast is covering Swamp Thing Volume 2, Annual 3. That's the one with Kong Gorilla on the cover, isn't it?
I don't know. My Swamp Thing knowledge is very poor. Very poor indeed. Interesting. Well, I know my
shame.
Then over on Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, they're covering Showcase number 77. Now, you can follow all of this on social media. Look for the hashtag JLApril2024. And we'll be using that on the show post for this as well. There'll be a link in the show notes so you can be sure to follow in. And, you know, since you mentioned something a minute ago, yeah, I completely forgot. You mentioned they're re-releasing the JL Ape trade, right? Okay. Yeah, maybe that's not the best news. But the other thing that we should have mentioned up front was that DC Comics this month did JL, or they didn't call it JL, they just called it April Special. April Special. And it was a couple of short stories, one with a bunch of apes, and then one with Detective Chimp, and then I think they got a couple others in there. It was a lot of fun. Do you happen to read that thing?
I read the first one. I've got a marker in before the Detective Chimp one. I didn't want it to soil or sully my podcast here, but I did see that Phil Hester's on art for that Detective Chimp story, and you can definitely count on some great stuff from Phil Hester.
Dude, so that first story, which is like a balls to the wall, crazy, a bunch of apes teaming up. You got Monkey Prince. I think that's his name, isn't it? Monkey Prince?
Yeah.
Yeah, Monkey Prince and Detective Chimp, and you got Sam Simeon and Gleek and all these characters. And that's a fun, wacky story. But the Detective Chimp story, holy crap, it's serious. And it's
all right.
And it's not intense. It's not intense, but it is tense. Let's put it that way. There's some suspense in there as far as like when you're reading it, what's going to happen. And it's really damn good. Really damn
That's
good.
Awesome.
So I would say April Special is worth checking out. It's already on the DC Infinite app. So if you're a subscriber, they loaded it day and date. They didn't make you wait a month for that one. So check it out. All right, folks, we are going to take a quick podcast promo break. And when we come back, we are going to talk about the Helmet of Fate Detective Chimp.
Chick, chick, why? What brick?
Celebrating the tradition of apes in comics, for 2024, Gorilla Grodd has transformed JL May into JL April, exploring a phylum of amazing apes, such as
Batman Annual number 23,
Wonder Woman number 170,
Kong on the Planet of the Apes issue 1,
Angel and the Ape,
The Helmet of Fate, Detective Chimp,
Showcase number 77,
JLA versus Godzilla versus Kong,
Swamp Thing Volume 2, Annual 3,
Kongorilla Issues 1 through 4,
with a host of podcast all-stars like
The Bat Pod,
Resurrections, an Adam Warlock and Thanos podcast,
Outcasters, a Batman and the Outsiders podcast,
Dolph of Flanger,
The Quarterbin Podcast,
Coffee and Comic,
Once Upon a Geek,
Fanholes Podcast,
Married with Content with John and Maggie,
Campus Comics Cast,
and many more. Look for the hashtag JLApril2024 on social media, the podcast crossover event that doesn't monkey around.
JLApril.
Damn dirty ape.
Monkey around? Really?
Chick-chick, why? Wood brick.
So here we sit in 2007, and they do this Helmet of Fate storyline, which is what we're touching on, right? We're covering one issue in that. And the where this whole thing came from was like Infinite Crisis. I'm assuming you read that, Doug, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So Dr. Fate and Nabu both dead, right? So the helmet is given to Detective Chimp, and he's supposed to find the next Dr. Fate. Do you remember what he does?
He gives it to Captain Marvel, who chucks it.
Exactly right. He basically says, all right, let's leave it to fate, you know, which is fitting, throws it into space. So fast forward, you know, a year or two to this storyline called Helmet of Fate. And it's a 5-issue loosely tied together one shots, basically. It's like this name, they gave the title to it. And it basically, the story is just 5 independent stories featuring like lesser known mystical characters like Detective Chimp, Black Alice, Zuriel. And then they introduce a new Ibis the Invincible, and they introduce a new Sargon the Sorcerer. And it's really, again, not really a crossover. So you don't feel like you need to read them all. You can read each one independently. It's fine. The only continuing theme is that the helmet keeps showing up. But really, other than Detective Chimp's story, like the helmet's really just a MacGuffin in any of those stories. Like it could have been any magical artifact. It didn't need to be the Dr. Fate helmet, except in this one. And this is sad. The sad part of this is originally, this Helmet of Fate thing was intended to be a springboard for a new ongoing series of Dr. Fate. In fact, once you get to the end of the collections, it even says coming is, you know, monthly Dr. Fate story. But sadly, Steve Gerber, the writer, he had a lot of health problems. And so they had to change plans. They ended up putting it in the Countdown to Mystery miniseries. And if I remember, I don't think Steve even finished it. I think he passed away before he could finish it, and someone else had to finish it for him, if I remember right.
Gosh, I didn't even remember that series till you said that just now.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, also wasn't very memorable. It wasn't terrible, but it wasn't one of those where you're like, oh yeah, Kent V. Nelson, I remember him. No, you really don't. So here we go. The other 4, because we're going to talk about Detective Chimp. Just briefly, do you have any memory of reading this thing or any thoughts on it?
I know I read all 5 of them.
Okay.
I don't remember any of them until I reread Detective Chimp here. And I especially don't remember anything else major of them, just because of the fact that it was a very empty series.
Yeah.
And like I said, it's a series of empty promises. Great concept, mediocre and slightly above execution, depending on who your creative team was, but no real delivery on the promise. The promise was this new Dr. Fate series that was going to be amazing, or at least intriguing. And it was definitely a case of DC overpromising and under-delivering for both the series and the one-shots.
No, that's absolutely fair. I would agree with that entirely. And it's a shame, too, because like, some of these, like the Detective Chimp story, I'm just going to show my hand early on. It's really good. I really enjoy it. So it's a lot of fun. And it is a great setup for a Dr. Fate thing. And I would say the Black Alice issue was also very good. Now, I'm an easy mark. I like anything that Black Alice is in. I don't know if she's even around in the New 52 Rebirth era. I have no idea. But I read a whole bunch of anything with Black Alice in the old days and loved that character. The Sargon story was actually entertaining. They introduced a new Sargon. It was, I should mention, Steve Niles and Scott Hampton did Sargon. Gail Simone and Duncan Rouleau, I can never say his name, did Black Alice. Ibis was Tad Williams and Phil Winslade. And Zuriel was Steve Gerber and Pete, I can't even say his name. It's like someone lost at Scrabble. Nijberg, I think. But the Sargon was, they set up a new character. There seemed to be some promise there. The art was Scott Hamilton, or Hampton. So I mean, it's really pretty to look at. But the Ibis story was, it was kind of a poor man Shazam story. And then Zuriel, well, it had a couple funny gags in it. Like watching Zuriel try to answer questions about religion to like a third grade class was hilarious. I mean, genuinely laugh out loud. The story itself was kind of weak. And it had Hyathus in it, so only Dr. Ange cared about it.
Oh, gosh. Oh.
So, again, none of them were connected. The Fate's Helmet. I mean, I guess I should say Fate's Helmet did play a little bit of a role in Black Alice, but again, it could have been any other MacGuffin, really. So, it was, yeah, I think you hit it right. It's overpromised, underdelivered, and kind of a bit hollow, which is sad.
Do you remember which one was the first one? Was it this Detective Chimp one?
Yes. So, I don't remember if the publication order was correct as far as reading, but like if you read the Zuriel issue, it tells mm-hmm. you the order of how it happened. Like, there's actually a recap where they go, like, it went here, and then the helmet went here. So, it is right. Detective Chimp, then Sargon, then Black Alice, then Ibis, then Zuriel. And none of this is on DC Infinite, by the way. So, you can't read them there. You just got to find other sources or get the trade or whatever. But I would say, again, Detective Chimp story is absolutely worth it. So why don't we get into that?
Absolutely. Let's go.
All right. So the issue is officially called Helmet of Fate, Detective Chimp number 1, published by DC Comics, cover dated March 2007, on the shelves January 17th, 2007. Cover price was $2.99. Page count was 22 pages. Cover is by Brian Bolland. I'm going to put you on the spot. You want to describe the cover?
Cover's amazing. It's by Brian Bolland. So it's got Bobo checking out the helmet, but it's not the Helmet of Fate as all of us Dr. Fate fans really come to know it, with the great mantle that covers the entire face. It's the one that was introduced. That's kind of the half mask. Mm-hmm. And Bobo's got a magnifying glass up to it. And Bolland does a great job with the cover and definitely caught the concept of the story in one image. But for me, the playfulness of McManus's art inside, kind of a contrast to the cover, much like Bolland's covers were for Chaz Trog's art back on the Animal Man series. So if you're going into this and you're looking at the cover and you're like, this is going to be amazing, and you open it up, it doesn't align. Not to say it's not good, because that Animal Man stuff was good too, but nobody can match Brian Bolland except Brian Bolland as far as detail and all that goes.
Interesting comparison. I hadn't thought about the comparison with Animal Man, because yeah, Bolland did all those too. Now, I'll just say it. I was not a fan of Chaz Trog's Animal Man art. I mean, there's certainly some stuff I enjoyed, but for the most part, I struggled. I read that book every month and I struggled. But here, I am such a mark for McManus. Like, I love his stuff so much. And his Dr. Fate 24 issues are part of my heart and soul. Like, they made me question my religious beliefs. I mean, those books are so powerful to me. And so I don't mind. I didn't have a problem with the contrast between that. In fact, I didn't even consider it until you mentioned it. The contrast of one artist on the front and a very different art inside. Wow. Didn't even think about that.
But they both work, you know, mm-hmm. and that's the beauty of having a Detective Chimp, is you can have multiple styles. And I mentioned Phil Hester earlier. You could look at those three drawings let's even bring Carmine and Fantino in here. You've got four different artists who are interpreting this character four different ways, and they're all right. Mm,
that's fair.
But back to the cover, the choice of, I don't know who the colorist is, not properly credited on the cover, but Brian Bolland drew the houndstooth or whatever that checker pattern is on the outfit, and the colorist went in and colored it. So if you can imagine this checkerboard, people, this is in 2007. Maybe they would have been computer coloring, but I'm not so sure that's the case. But
I'm sure it was computer coloring. It had to be by then, because I mean, they were doing that in the 90s. But still, the amount, I didn't even think about that, man. Like the tweed or whatever it is.
Yeah,
I didn't even think about the level of colorist, because you look at the details, like, oh my god, you're right. They would have gone mad.
Yeah, and now that's a simple AI cheat, I'm sure. But you know, it is what it is. And back then, 2007, it was something totally different. And the thing that I really want to just make note of here, going back again to getting the apes right when you're drawing apes in comics, is they chose to make Bobo a little more dusky. And if you look at the inside of the comic again with McManus's art, his cheeks, his ears, his eyes, or the skin around his eyes is more flesh tone, more like a human Caucasian color. Mm-hmm. Whereas true chimpanzees, as they get older, their skin gets darker. So in this case, what we're seeing on the cover is the decision to make Bobo look a little bit older. And again, the story can play either way. And I've seen it with different creators all the way through since Bobo's rise to prominence 20 years ago. In some stories, he's got this duskier color. In some, he's got that more fleshy tone. And they're both right.
I had no idea, first of all, about the coloring as far as their faces go. I had no idea that was a thing with age. And you're right, it does add a lot to it. And part of it maybe is the colorist was thinking about, because Ballin's style is ultra realistic. I mean, that looks like a real chimpanzee. It doesn't look like a comic book chimpanzee, which is also part of why the cover works so well. Because like the ultra realistic style of the chimp, just such a contrast to the ridiculous Sherlock Holmes outfit he's wearing. I mean, it's just absurd, which is why I love the way those two mesh together, the ultra realism with the absurdity. So I did not think about the, so I guess what's going on here, if they're really going for as realistic as they can, the colorist must have been like, all right, I've already been driven mad adding all the yellow and the orange and the blue to the tweed, so I'm going to get this all right, is probably what happened there. I do love Absolutely. That you can even see the reflection of Bobo in the glass, and I wonder if that was statted in. I almost think it had to be statted in, as the lines look so similar, but there's a lot of attention to detail going on here. And we said earlier, I mean, the cover's so darn good. They put it on the Detective Chimp casebook even when this issue isn't in there.
Crazy.
All right, well, let's get into this thing. So this is the case of the massively the case of the massively magical monkey mage. Writer is Bill Willingham. Artist is Sean McManus. Letter is Travis Lanham. Colorist, at least on the inside, is Michael Atiyah. And the editor is Joey Cavallari. Now, I'm going to read the recap here. It's a little longer than I wanted to, but I'm going to blow through it as quick as I can. So a lot happens in this. As the issue opens, Bobo has been called in by the Gotham Police Department to help investigate the mysterious murder of a group of new heroes that were found in a hotel room. Bobo stuns everyone by solving the entire case in just a few moments after just a quick glance around the room. And I gotta tell you, people, I am selling this short because it is 7 pages of Bobo being freaking brilliant and amazing. It is so good. But in the spirit of brevity, I gotta keep going here. So Bobo leaves the crime scene and he's searching for the mystical door that'll lead to the Shadow Pack headquarters. And he is bonked on the head by the Helmet of Fate. So after a year or so floating around the cosmos, it's returned to Earth, hurtled through the atmosphere, and specifically sought out Bobo. And the helmet has changed some, too. It now fits Bobo perfectly. So when the Detective Chimp puts on the helmet, he is suddenly aware of everything. And I mean everything. He understands the cosmos and the sentient stars. He knows every person's secret thoughts and how those affect others. He even knows the Kentucky Fried Chicken's secret 11 herbs and spices.
That's insane, isn't it?
It's almost too much to believe. I can believe a chimpanzee in detective clothes, but that's a bridge too far. So Bobo's omniscience, it's troubling. Like, he knows everything, right? So some punks try to mug him, but Bobo scares them off by sharing, like, incredibly detailed, unknowable facts. Like, one thug has just unknowingly contracted HIV by sharing a needle. He doesn't even know it himself. The other thug's sister is in danger from a depraved neighbor. And Bobo, he puts a Dr. Fate costume on because he's magical, right? But he's overwhelmed with the knowledge and he can't make a decision. He's like paralyzed. Like, see, he knows every person on the planet and he knows every person who's in danger. And there's a whole lot of those. And how does he decide what person to help? Like, how does he weigh one life against another? It's too much for him. So he finally decides to just finish the case that he already started. So he visits the Gotham police detective he was working with earlier in the day, and they bust those responsible for the murder of those heroes found in the hotel room. That includes the new trickster, Axel Walker, which I guess by now he's not new anymore, is he? It's been 20 years, or more than that. Anyway, and an alien who sells magic artifacts on the black market. Afterwards, you know, Bobo, he's still overwhelmed, right, with all this knowledge. And the biggest part of this, it's compounded by his knack for solving mysteries. So, like, Bobo can see every single thing in the world and how it's connected and the impact that every other thing in the world has. And he has, it's because of his detective abilities. So he feels paralyzed. He can't help anyone. So, because he also knows that his solutions will just cause other problems. So ultimately, it's too much for him. He relinquishes the helmet, returning it on its cosmic journey to find the next successor to Dr. Fate. Now, that residual knowledge lasts for about 5 days. So Bobo uses his detective skills to the fullest. In Baltimore, and this cracks me up, he provides notes and evidence to solve 18 years worth of unsolved murders. Right. And he kept solving in, like, the most outlandish crimes until the cosmic awareness is finally fades. In the end, Bobo decides that with the Helmet of Fate, it gave him a lot, but he feels like he added something to the helmet, an awareness of human foibles and follies, and hopefully it'll help the next Dr. Fate. So that's a lot. That was a lot. It's interesting that in a story where the beginning point and the ending point are the same, you know, it's really kind of what would Paul call it, an occupier or whatever, or a filler?
Yeah.
It's still full of a lot of stuff. So what'd you think of it, man?
Oh, I hadn't thought of it as an occupier or a filler until you just said that now, because... Everything's returned exactly the way it was, right?
Yep.
But for my money, it was a fun concept with a bunch of random pieces kind of thrown together. There's got Dr. Fate and Bobo and Trickster. And really, is this where Bobo gets more ingrained? I know, I guess it happened with Shadow Pact, but just as far as becoming magical, I mean, as a detective chimp, how magical is that really? But what we see in this issue is less lean into that magic and a whole lot of the lean into the detective. And Bobo one hell of a detective. You can almost hear him talking through the story, and I don't know whose voice it would be, but you can almost hear that voice going, and you see over here, that went on right there. Why this isn't a series yet, or a television series, or a movie? Somebody's missing money. But not only does Fate empower Bobo to finish the case, but the power of Fate amplifies Bobo's natural state. Like you mentioned that it paralyzes him.
Yeah.
It gives him that analysis paralysis where he sees all the different things he can do, from helping his friends on Shadow Pact to solving those crimes to solving pandemics and things. And I'm putting words out there, but I'm sure those are things that weren't necessarily listed, but he was going on and on with so many things to do.
Yeah. And his omniscience was crippling, because he also found that he couldn't stop talking about it. Like there was one, and this isn't about saving the world, but just his omniscience that I found fascinating. Like he meets up with this female detective and she puts on a nightgown because they're like at her apartment. And he just starts talking. He can't stop himself. He knows the woman who finished the hand stitching on the nightgown, that woman just discovered she has an inoperable liver cancer. And he knows that her husband is cheating on her with her best friend. And he can't stop piecing it all together, because like you mentioned, the detective skills. He can't stop seeing the threads.
Yeah. And I'm curious. I don't have it all ingrained. I maybe haven't even read all of it. But when Bobo comes across Fate again, what those conversations are like, right? Mm. Is there a little bit of the hint of Bobo in the helmet that he was hoping for? You know, that's neither here nor there. That's random speculation. But the story itself, the omniscience, when he puts the helmet on, there's a splash page that McManus just draws everything into. There's a little bit of Kirby Crackle, well, a lot of Kirby Crackle. There's meteors and dinosaurs and sea serpents and pyramids, and you can just feel it. It's so immersive that McManus and colorist Michael Atea just fill that page with something that would just be poster worthy.
Yeah, it's super fun. And I mentioned earlier, I'm an easy mark for McManus anyway. And then I loved his Dr. Fate run. So having him doing something Dr. Fate related, even though it's not strictly Dr. Fate, he always had a knack for drawing creatures and drawing people as a cartoonist would. Like they're very exaggerated, and yet they're immediately identifiable. You don't mistake anyone for anyone else. It's not simple cartoony. It's just exaggerated, and it's gorgeous. And yeah, that one page with the dinosaur and the pyramids and everything, it's just stunning. I'm so happy every time I get to read one of his comics.
Absolutely. And now it's got me wanting to dig back into those Fate issues that you've mentioned.
Oh, they're so good. You should also check out J.M. DeMatteis's The Multiverse. He's got a story in there too, which is absolutely wonderful. And they're working on the second round of those right now. Those are recent stuff if you want to read more by McManus. So good.
Are those readily available, or were they Kickstarter only?
It was a Kickstarter, but I think you can get them now. I'm pretty sure. You'd have to look it up. But again, just look for The Multiverse and you guys absolutely can check that out. So big fan of that. So I want to go back real quick to the beginning, the first seven pages of Bobo solving that crime. And I just love that he's a dick, right? Like the cops are like starting to ask questions. He's like, shut up. Don't interrupt me while I'm working. This is not a discussion. I am going to lecture and I'm only going to say it once and you better write it down. And then he just starts leaving and they have to follow him and they pepper him with more questions. Like, fine, you want to do this? Fine, we'll do it. I'll explain it. And he explains to them step by step everything he sees. Like he counts the number of plates in the room. He knows about the, you know, that he figures out intuitively like what kind of socioeconomic status they're in based on the hotel room, and then how they found somebody and how they are all murdered in different ways. And it's just a joy to, it's like watching an episode of Columbo, you know, like in seven pages. You know, it's a joy to watch him solve this crime and be like, wow.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that if you saw it on a screen, it would enthrall the audience.
Oh, yeah. It'd be like Ant-Man where they tell the ridiculous flashbacks, that kind of thing, right?
No, I was thinking it'd be more like the solution or the revelation of Murder on the Orient Express.
Right? Oh, where okay. All right.
It all comes together and you're like, of course.
Right. Yeah. I mean, once he says all of it, it seems obvious. You're like, oh, that makes perfect sense. Why didn't I think of that? Yeah. It's because Bill Willingham, it just has a knack, first of all, for writing Bobo. And I guess he's got a knack for writing mysteries as well. And he's really responsible, though, for bringing Bobo to the public consciousness. I mean, he did Day of Vengeance. He did Shadow Pack. He's doing this. So really, Bobo was kind of his for a number of years until he ended up in Justice League Dark, I guess. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I guess it was kind of his character.
That's cool.
Yeah. Huh.
Well, I think we've actually entered a space where Bobo should have his own series, whether that's television or comic or what have you. There's capacity for it. Just make sure the artist is drawing a chimpanzee that looks like a chimpanzee.
Well, I was going to say, so are we talking CGI for a TV series or animated?
Oh, it'd have to be CGI. I mean, Umbrella Academy has a chimp, right?
That's true. Yeah, that's true. But it's also pretty expensive to do that. You know, animated might be easier. Like, they did him in Batman Brave and the Bold.
I'm trying to remember that one. I was sure he was there. And I'm trying to remember what episodes he was in and who the voice was.
I can't help you out. I just know he was there.
Sounds like something for the comments.
There we go, folks. Chime in. I know Chris Franklin's going to be the first one to chime in. So, see if you can beat him, folks. Also, I love at the end when he shows up at the precinct and he's got the giant stack of paper that's almost as tall as him. And it's every unsolved crime for the last 18, or unsolved murder for the last 18 years. That is freaking hilarious. I laughed really hard at that.
And not only that, but he calls out another officer while he's dropping off that paperwork.
Right. He's walking out the door. He's like, that guy's on the take. And I'm flipping through here, just blown away by so much of McManus's stuff. You know, when Bobo puts on the Dr. Fate outfit, it's hysterically funny. You know, the Gotham detective lady, she's beautiful and kind of sexy. And then you got the trickster. Just so much beautiful art. Every page is just gorgeous and fun and just full of character.
Yeah, and that's what it was. It was just a fun issue.
Yeah.
And in that case, so it doesn't deliver on the promise of, you know, more Dr. Fate stuff or some great Simeon adventures, but we've still got this issue. It's still something we can pick up and have a good time reading.
Exactly. And it is fun. You said the word fun. It is absolutely what it is. That's why I would sum this up. It's fun. Again, it's an occupier or a filler. Who cares? It told a great story. You had a blast doing it. And I feel better for it. And like you said, it's inspired us to want more Detective Chimp, you know, adventures on television now because this is so good.
Yeah. Let's go. Let's do it.
All right. Well, I'm thrilled. I'm glad we did this, Doug. Thank you for being my co-pilot on this. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And when we get another Detective Chimps story in about 17 years, we can have at it again.
Hey, we could always get back together to cover April special.
Oh, there you go.
Let me know when you finish reading that Detective Chimp story in there. I think you're going to really like it. It's good. It's really
good. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's going to be my next task as soon as we stop recording here, my friend.
Yeah. I expect a text at like 11 at night saying how damn good it was. Now, Doug, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit and keeping your eye on this Dr. Fate helmet? I'm a little worried that one of the guys from the Fire and Water Podcasting Network might be tempted to put it on. And I really don't need that kind of headache. I don't need an all-knowing podcast partner. I mean, Siskoid and Rob already act like they know everything. And you can only imagine the damage Ryan Daly would do with this thing.
Oh, man. We cannot let Daly anywhere near this thing.
It would be a disaster. Absolutely.
It would be. Even if it's just the half helmet, that'd still be a disaster. Then we'd have to see half his face still, right?
Exactly right. Well, I appreciate you watching that, Doug. And don't worry, we will bring you back at the end of the show. And after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback from the past few episodes.
Chick, chick, why? What brick?
So, Mike, what are you doing? It's like you're deep in thought.
Oh, I've just been sitting here thinking. Do you know how many years you and I have been podcasting together for?
Eight?
Higher.
Eight?
Just over 10 years now, Paul. And do you know how many different shows we do these days?
What, three?
Higher.
Three?
No, we actually do four different shows. And do you know how many episodes we've done across all four of those?
10,000?
Lower.
10,000?
But look, we're doing Waiting for Doom. That's the Doom Patrol-related podcast where each episode we talk about our favourite superhero team, the Mighty Doom Patrol.
Oh, yeah. And we also do DC OCD, where we talk about DC events, covering every event from Crisis on Infinite Earths up.
Yeah, and we also do the Gary Show, which is generally just you and I talking about anything and everything that comes to mind.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one. Yeah, and what's the other one we do?
Dial F for Flanger, which is your pop culture chat show, where you get a different guest in each episode to talk about something pop culture related. How cool is all that?
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So if you want to check out more champagne comedy and sparkling wit like you just heard in this very promo, head over to WaitingForDoom.com and you'll find all our awesome shows.
Did you say champagne comedy?
I did.
Lower.
Chick chick why? Wood brick.
And now, your feedback from recent episodes of Once Upon a Geek. All right, folks. Well, first off, a request, if you would. Would you please consider leaving a review on iTunes for the podcast? It really helps raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. And while the Fire and Water Podcast Network itself, you know, it's been around a long time, it's got a lot of iTunes reviews, this particular show, it's still finding its feet, so it could use the boost. Also, as a way of saying thank you, I will read your iTunes reviews in their entirety during the feedback segment of the show, just like these wonderful people who are very much appreciated. First up is JLB76, who wrote in about the Ted Lasso episode on iTunes. They said, anyone who has enjoyed Ted Lasso should listen to the Ted Lasso episode. Anyone who wants to know why so many of us love that show should listen to this episode. As a bonus, Shag has a great speaking voice, perfect for a podcast and a radio announcer DJ. Wow, JLB, thank you so much. The check's in the mail for that. yes, I often say I have the perfect voice for radio. Or no, face for radio. That's what it is, a face for radio. Then we get an iTunes review from Ryan Daly, who says, great podcast, and I'm not totally writing this because the host is my friend. He writes, listen to the show, this is all. Oh, well, thank you, Ryan. I appreciate that. And the most important thing I took away from that is that Ryan called me his friend. Squee! Then we hear from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who writes, great show! Shag and his guests do a great job bringing you into this wonderful geeky world and helping us all find our joy. Keep up the great work. Best way to sum up the show is, come for the topic, stay for Shag. Aw, well thank you, Bucky. I sincerely appreciate that. Alright, now, as promised, I will be covering comments from our website specifically, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. And thank you to everyone who leaves comments on our website for the show. I mean, I really, really sincerely appreciate it. You know, since the topic of this show changes every month. You know, it's kind of hard to build a consistent listenership and commenters, so I really appreciate y'all all that much more. This time out, we're going to cover comments from recent episodes on Ted Lasso with my guest Captain Entropy and Patrick Pence, the episode on Doctor Who Fury from the Deep with my guest Justin from the Fanholes, the What If episode covering Volume 1, Number 46 and Volume 2, Number 66 with my guest Chris Franklin, and Daredevil, Number 268 with my guest J. David Weider. Now, remember, the feedback from the Blue Devil episodes will be featured on the following Blue Devil specific episodes. All right, so feedback from those four episodes we'll be talking about. I have taken all that feedback from our website and put it all into Google Doc. It is 20 pages long. You folks are amazing. So what I'm going to be doing is just reading bits and pieces of it so we can get through it all in a reasonable amount of time, but I still want to make sure I recognize everyone who left feedback. So now, if somehow I missed anyone who left a comment on our website, I do sincerely apologize. Let me know and drop me a line. First up, Ted Lasso. Again, our guests were Captain Entropy and Patrick Pence. First up was Comic Foil says, great episode, guys. I want to be there right in the room discussing it with you, which is the highest compliment I can give. Then they say, I wholeheartedly believe the show will return without Ted Lasso continuing the story with all the other characters. Oh, well, thank you, Comic Foil. And yes, that is the highest compliment you could pay, is listening to the show and wanting to be part of it. So thank you. Then we're from Paul Hicks from the Waiting for Doom podcast, the DCOCD podcast, and much more. Paul says, I kind of fear any continuation in case it doesn't capture the magic. You know, Paul, I'm right there with you. You know, the idea of continuing with Coach Beard, Coach Kent, and Nathan without Ted, it just seems to be more of the same, but missing that spark of Ted for me. So that's why in my suggestions on the show, I really leaned into featuring the other characters in completely new situations. So, all right, then we heard from Chris Pine, the guy who crashed the dentist convention to steal free drinks and appetizers. Chris says, I've wanted to check out Once Upon a Geek for a while, and when I saw a Ted Lasso episode pop up, I knew I found my way in. I adored that show and was so pleased to hear the three of you talk about it. Then he goes on to say, for me, Ted Lasso is about when you have to realize that the life you've envisioned for yourself isn't exactly the one that you're living, and how to find peace, balance, and joy from that. Then Chris goes on to say, I have a nonverbal autistic child. And probably like a lot of parents, you have these dreams and ideas of your life that the children will have. Things you'll teach them, share with them, help shape them as little people into young adults. And when you have an autistic kid, you have to learn that a lot of that won't happen. And you have to find a way to make peace with that. And that's the theme I got from Ted Lasso. Over and over, characters have to let go of some of the things that they are not in order to find out who they are and to find happiness in that rather than grieve the life that they do not have. Wow, Chris, thank you for the feedback and for your openness. I love that someone else can be passionate about the show and get a completely different message from it. And that's the magic of the show. So it really speaks to all of us in those different ways, Ted Lasso does. And you make a lot of powerful points, and you sound like a really fantastic dad. And thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing your story with us. All right, next we heard from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He talks a little bit about some different 90s soccer cartoons in his comments. Then we heard from Doug Adamson, who says... we can't overlook how much COVID impacted Ted Lasso and likewise how much this show impacted COVID. There simply isn't many feel-good shows on TV. To that extent, Ted Lasso was effectively in a league of its own for the last few years, carving out a TV landscape that perhaps would only have a handful of shows at best. People didn't really tune into the show to see the plot, but to follow the lives of the characters. And then Doug goes on quite a bit, folks. You should go out to the website and check it out. It's a lot of great stuff. But I'm just picking and choosing little bits. And he says, talking about the comedy, someone posted online during the run that the topics the show covered, such as Colin and Trent's story, you know, Ted's panic attacks, the racism, the crazy rich dudes, all felt like those episodes of U.S. comedies where it was, quote, tonight on a very special episode. Yet at the same time, it never once felt forced. And while there was certainly something they wanted to get across, it never beat you over the head with it because everyone seemed real. Again, the writing and the acting in the show made all of this possible. Yeah, Doug, I mean, there's so many things that we got to unpack in that episode of Once Upon a Geek, and we didn't even get to touch on. So yeah, great points. Then we heard from Chris Lewis, who says, Ted Lasso has absolutely no right to be as good as it turned out. It should have been a one-gag sitcom about what is, in the United States at least, something of a niche sport. But it's so much more. I think the show is about seeing the characters improving and maintaining their mental health in a world in which is complicated and fluid and unsettling, and one which rarely, if ever, really lives up to their hopes and expectations. And I'm making a definite distinction here between mental health, which is maintaining a healthy psyche, and actual mental illness. There are times when the characters do show symptoms of mental illness, like Ted's panic attacks, for example. For much of the time, however, the characters have their own flaws and foibles, but manage to deal with issues in ways that feel more genuine and true to real life than most of the overly dramatic characterizations you generally see on TV drama. Then Chris goes, again, great comments from Chris. He says quite a few things, but at the end he says, Shag, you said you feel your spirit animal is Roy Kent, but for your positivity and find your joy energy, I'll always think of you more as a Ted. Oh, wow. You know, Chris, I appreciate that. Ted is certainly aspirational, probably for all of us, but Roy's the voice in my head. Let's just put it that way. How's that? Especially like when I'm in traffic. All right, then we heard from Jeff Tischer, who says, I got a chance to listen to this with my wife on the way back from Canada, which was a 7-hour road trip each way. It led to some amazing discussion and observations about the show. We had to pause many times so that we could talk about our own takes on specific characters and scenes. It wound up taking us nearly 3 hours to get through it, and I couldn't have been happier. Then it goes on to say, I think my biggest beef would have been with Beard's wedding. I know thematically it was to show that Ted was back in the United States and had moved on, but knowing the kind of person Ted is and his relationship with Beard, there's no way he wouldn't have hopped back on a plane and come over for the celebration. Moving on doesn't mean you ditch your friends. It means your relationships with them change. That's a great point, Jeff. In fact, Captain Entropy, the guest on the show, follows up and says, Jeff, very glad our conversation spurred a great conversation with your wife. And if listening to a podcast gives us something worthwhile to talk about, it's a win. Helping us connect with someone we care about then is a spectacular win. That's great. Thank you so much, Captain Entropy, for summing that up. Then we're from Ryan Daly, who says, the major theme of the show, the one word essence, as you'd asked, I think is coaching. And if you'll allow me an extra word, though, I would amend that to life coaching. At his or her core, a coach is someone dedicated to helping others find success, developing a player or team's skills and attributes, facilitating a culture in which they can thrive and improve. And on the surface, that's what Ted is in Richmond there to do, to help this football club succeed. But as he says in his first press conference, as he says to Trent during the interview, and as he reiterates time and time again to Ted, it's not about the wins and losses. It's about helping people be the best version of themselves. And that's what we see throughout the series. Then Ryan goes on to say, I was happy with where Ted ended up in the final scene, coaching Little League soccer. I predicted that as early as season one, that it was in fact where Ted actually belonged. There was a scene in the pub between Ted and Beard when Ted repeats his disinterest in wins and losses, and Beard shockingly rejects that idea for the first time. Because in the real world, that whole philosophy and practice is great for kids and for students, but AFC Richmond was made of professional footballers. There's consequences to losing. People's livelihood are tied to the team's wins and losses. Even the profit margins of May's pub ebbed and flowed with the team's record. And Ted was still never able to compromise his core values for the sake of a victory at all costs type of attitude, which is why he didn't belong there in the long term. He was the coach, manager that Richmond needed at the time because they were kids in many ways. As your guest pointed out on the podcast, everyone in the club was kind of broken when Ted showed up. They weren't ready to win the Premier League championship until Ted coached them, not in football, but in life. Once that journey was over, though, once Richmond was grown up enough to thrive personally and professionally, it was time for Ted to move on. So no, we didn't need another season. Woof. All right. So, you know, a lot of people wrote a lot of feedback, I should say, not just to the people I mentioned. Everybody really poured their hearts out on that episode. We got so many comments on the Ted Lasso episode. Folks, I strongly encourage you, go out to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek, find the Ted Lasso episode, and read all that feedback. I mean, it was amazing and moving and kind of cathartic for all of us, I think, to share our thoughts and feelings. So it's well worth your time to go check that out. All right. Now we're going to move on to the next episode, which was Doctor Who Fury from the Deep, the animated episode that I covered with my guest, Justin, from the Fan Holes. We heard from Chris Lewis again. He goes, thanks for the great show, guys. A wonderful tribute to the 60th anniversary. Fury of the Deep is a perfectly decent story. Its reputation has been bolstered by the fact that the original episodes have been wiped from existence. That said, the gas-emitting scene of Quill and Oak is extremely creepy and would surely have frightened the pants off any unsuspecting kids in the 60s. Heck, Quill's wide-eyed, gaping-mouth expression scares the crap out of me to this day. Yes, it was very terrifying, not only in the animated thing, but yeah, the photos from that episode that exist are deeply disturbing. All right, then we heard from Super Captain, who says, Doctor Who has been my favorite TV show since I discovered it on the local PBS affiliate in the early 1980s. Back then, it was John Pertwee, Tom Baker, and Peter Davison episodes that were shown, but when I was in high school, the station began showing the black and white episodes on weekday afternoons. As far as my favorite Second Doctor story, that would be The Mind Robber, followed closely by The War Games. Oh, those are both so good, Super Captain. Great choices. The former features the kind of premise that you would only find on Doctor Who, and I love the TARDIS cruise encounters with Gulliver and the superhero from Zoe's time. Yeah, it's hard to beat Jamie and Zoe when it comes to companion duos. And then Super Captain shares a little bit about himself. He says, in my secret identity, I serve as a pastor, and Shag may be interested to know that I titled a recent sermon, Find Your Joy, inspired by this very podcast series. Wow, Super Captain. I'm just blown away. I don't even know what to say. I am so honored that it may have inspired anything in you to make you want to talk about that and share that with your congregation, maybe? I think it's the right term. I'm not sure. But either way, I am incredibly flattered. I told my wife when you wrote that, I was just blown away. So thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate that. Okay. Up next, we heard from Siskoid from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, who has a bunch of shows on our network, including Siskoid Cinema, that has a sub-show called On Borrowed Time. It's all about time travel movies. So hey, you know, you like Doctor Who, you might like that. Check it out. He says, The Highlanders is my pick for recovering a lost Doctor Who episode. Though to be fair, they've animated so much of the lost stuff in the Second Doctor era that my wish list has more First Doctor in it now. The Mythmakers is probably of the highest priority. All right, then we hear from Brian Linton. Says, over the years, Patrick Troughton has become one of my favorite classic doctors, along with Sylvester McCoy. So it was great to hear you cover one of Troughton's lost episodes. He says, when my wife received a BritBox subscription a few years ago, the first thing I did was rewatch all the classic Who episodes that they had available. One of the best parts of that rewatch was discovering the animated reconstructions. Talk about finding your joy. Oh, yeah, BritBox is great for binging old episodes. Yeah. Thank you, Brian. Then we hear from Bucky749 again. It says, the first classic Doctor Who story my family all watched together was Remembrance of the Daleks. Ooh, that's a good one, Bucky. Then Bucky shared lots of other stuff about his personal Doctor Who fandom, but I'll just read a couple things. His favorite modern Doctor is Peter Capaldi. His favorite classic Doctor is John Pertwee. His favorite Doctor Who villain is the Yeti. Oh, I love the Yeti. And favorite classic Doctor Who story is the Web of Fear. Oh, great choices, Bucky. All right, moving on to the next episode, What If Volume Number 1, covering issue 46, which was a Spider-Man story, and What If Volume 2, Number 66, which was a Rogue Thor story, with my guest Chris Franklin. Rob McCarthy wrote in to say, I think think this was the best What If based on Spider-Man. And then the second story, Black. Not sure I like Rogue absorbing magic. Hey, I get it, Rob. Not every story can be somebody's favorite. Sorry I didn't enjoy it. I did, though. Then we'll hear from Super Captain again, who says, always love some alternate Earth action. Like Chris, I suspect that What If didn't always appear on the spinner racks at the newsstand where I bought my comics. One that I definitely remember was very well was What If number 9, What If the Avengers formed in the 1950s? The team was 3D Man, Venus, yes, that Venus from Roman myths, Marvel Boy, who would become Quasar eventually, I think, Human Robot, and my personal favorite, of course, Gorilla Man. Super Captain, that is a super fun What If story. And if you're not aware, boy, you are in for a treat. One of my favorite comic book writers is Jeff Parker. He wrote some Aquaman stories. He's written a ton of stuff. Anyway, he then sort of took the challenge of that story and collected those characters in a team called Agents of Atlas. And he's written a bunch of Agents of Atlas series. You can get them collected. You can read them on Marvel Unlimited. Anyway, if you enjoy those characters, check out Agents of Atlas. Now, it doesn't take place in the 50s. It takes place in modern day. But it is so much fun. It's a great comic. Again, Jeff Parker is just phenomenal. So if you enjoyed that What If, I think you'll enjoy Agents of Atlas. All right, then we heard from Bucky749 again, giving some of his own recommendations for What If stories. He also plugged that same exact issue about Avengers fighting in the 1950s. It's issue number 9. He also said, Volume 1, issue 28, What If Daredevil Became an Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.? Yeah, I really like that story as well. Then we heard from my buddy Andy Leyland, who has shows such as Hey Kids Comics, Palace of Glittering Delights, and other things on the Two True Freaks Network. He says, good show, guys. Chris classes up everything he's in. regarding Spider-Man and Great Responsibility, because we specifically put the question out to him, he says, when I looked at the origin of the phrase, the article I referenced was Brian Cronin's on CBR, in which he states that the phrase, with great power, there must also come great responsibility, was first attributed to Uncle Ben in, of all places, a 1972 rock comic. It did not appear in the comics until either Amazing Spider-Man 274, written by Tom DeFalco, but this is a hallucination, or 1987 Spider-Man vs. Wolverine number 1, written by Jim Owsley. It's possible that Owsley, as the editor of Amazing Spider-Man 274, believed that DeFalco was referencing something else, and it was always thus. So I'm kind of leaning towards giving the credit to DeFalco. Wow, Andy. What a knowledge bomb. Thank you so much for sharing. That is fascinating. And to think a phrase that is just part of the common lexicon of just the general populace now, everyone knows that expression, that it took that long for it to be part of Spider-Man's, you know, universe. Wow, amazing. So thank you, Andy. And then David A. Gutierrez follows up Andy's statement saying, you and Chris bring the class, Leyland. What with you drinking with your pinky raised and Chris in his ascot. My gosh, David. Then we heard from Siskoid again. It says, What If number 46 was one of my first What Ifs. I started with What If Captain America Were Revived Today, two issues earlier, so it was important as an early issue from my point of view and didn't have the Marvel Universe ending or whatever. It showed that What If wasn't a one-trick massacre and cemented my love for the series. As for Volume 2, number 66, it's after I quit the series, but as some of the hallmarks of the second series that I found annoying, in particular being vague about the turning point. But it's also emblematic of the 90s-ness that had taken over the series. It's about a member of the X-Men. We're lucky it's not Wolverine this time. And it's one of those power swaps that, to me, were the laziest of what-ifs. What if Wolverine was a vampire? What if Wolverine was an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.? This Rogue story seemed to go in interesting places, though. But in concept, I find these kinds of what-ifs a little thin in terms of premise. Cool, but not deep. Kind of like the 90s. Siskoid, you make some great points. You really do. But I found this story to be interesting because Rogue didn't just get the power. She became a god, which was sort of interesting. And like you said, the universe didn't end. So I don't know. It was something different. It was different compared to the other what-ifs at the time. So I enjoyed it. So then we heard from Chris Pine again, who says, I found it interesting how Pete and Ben shared this guilt where they both felt like they could have been a hero to save May, which is possibly unintended, but a solid commentary on masculinity. And it appears to absolve Pete of almost any responsibility, where he becomes kind of a puppet. Uncle Ben might be a terrible person for Pete to be around when he's Spider-Man. As far as Volume 2, number 66, goes, I wasn't familiar or that interested, but it's actually pretty good. I'm also confused by Odin's being powerless to do anything about what was happening, but a happy ending. Even if it is in right, ridiculous, scrappy clothes, it's a pretty welcome conclusion to a what if. I'm glad you saw this the way I did, Chris. That's awesome. Then we heard from my buddy Ward Hill Terry, who says, it wasn't until I listened to this podcast and I was thinking about it later that I realized realize the untold aspect of the story is that without Aunt May, her friend Anna has no reason to call on Uncle Ben. So Anna never introduces her niece to Peter. What if Mary Jane married Harry Osborn? That is a fascinating idea, Warthill Terry. In fact, Chris Franklin followed it up, saying, Terry, I was going to bring up MJ and also the fact that Ben figured out Peter's secret identity the same way MJ was revealed to have done so shortly after this issue was published, by seeing Spider-Man swing into Parker's house. So, did MJ know the secret in this universe too, but avoided Peter since Anna probably wasn't as pushy with Ben? Or maybe after a few years, Ben and Anna started dating and possibly marrying, which would make Peter and MJ semi-related. The mind boggles. All right, then we have from Michael Sulka, who says, I also live in an area with little to no spinner rack presence for the What If Volume 1. Now, Volume 2 had some enticing stories toward the beginning and became a C-tier book for me, something I would happily pick up if there were no favorites on the rack at the time. A few Volume 2 stories that stick out in my mind are the End of the World crossovers, like Atlantis Attacks, Inferno, The Evolutionary War. Each had stories where our heroes lost the big event. In the case of the first two, it saw lots of death and unusual alliances. The Evolutionary War was the best of the three as it presented the outcome as something possibly good, even if the ethics of getting there were deeply flawed. Then he mentions What If Daredevil Killed Kingpin? This tied in heavily with the Spidey gang war stuff, and it led to a new status quo I wish could have been explored further. My other favorite is What If the X-Men Stayed in Asgard? Half of the X-Men and New Mutants stick around to live in Asgard as their life looks to be better there. It is a mix of tragedy and triumph, tells an epic tale within 22 pages, and leaves you wanting to know about the folks who choose to return to Earth. Valentino crushes it on script and art. Thank you, Michael. That sounds awesome. I don't know if I've read that one or not. I feel like I have, but I don't have any memory of it. And Valentino, in the 90s, man, he doesn't get enough credit. He did some really cool stuff over at Marvel. I've read a lot of different what-ifs that he did were good, or like the Guardians of the Galaxy comic he did was a lot of fun. So, yeah, awesome. Thank you for sharing. Now, from Lucien Desar says, great episode. I read What If Volume 2, number 66, What If Rogue Possessed the Power of Thor, and wow, was it extreme 90s. I loved it. Even the 90s artwork style and Rogue's haircut. Not once was it boring, which probably means I need to get in my TARDIS and go back and live in 1984 again. Keep up the good work and have a Crystal Pepsi on me. Thank you, Lucy. Then Chris Lister said, Aunt May ages in reverse. That's a good way to look at it, considering how she looked in this comic compared to, say, Marissa Tomei. All right, then moving on to Daredevil, where we covered issue number 268 with my guest, J. David Weider. First comment was from Siskoid. He says, great episode, and you used one of my favorite issues of Daredevil as an example, too. When I think of D.D.'s senses, the first story I think of is this one, and how we basically come to understand the story is through his senses. This and the Axe of Vengeance Ultron issues make this a proto-Vertigo as much as Morrison's Animal Man and Doom Patrol, which did not carry the Vertigo imprint, which is something we easily forget. And it's in this run that made me a lifelong fan. Oh, that's awesome. And you know, you make a good point about being kind of a more thinking, mature, maybe, Marvel book at the time. Yeah. Then her from Brian Schufo says, was anyone else's first introduction to Daredevil from those single color plastic statues around 1970 with the pie in the face pose? They came in different colors, and my Daredevil was appropriately red compared to the lime green Spider-Man, which I also had, which meant the colors couldn't be trusted. I had no idea who he was or what his special powers were, but I knew it had to have something to do with his stop pose. And he shared a picture. It's like Daredevil sitting there with his hand out like a stop, you know, like a policeman might tell you to stop. And Brian goes on to say, could he stop bullets with it? Could he shoot laser beams? I had no idea, but he still looked cool. Super Captain chimed in as well, saying he also had some of those Marvel statues and he's been trying to describe them for years. Bucky749 shares, he says, I've been reading Daredevil and I'm reading the Mighty Marvel Masterworks Volume 2. He says, I'm on issue number 18 and Foggy is pretending to be Daredevil to impress the secretary, and the Gladiator shows up. He says, my Daredevil origins is with the Spider-Man and Daredevil DVD. I've only recently gotten into the character in the comics. Very cool, Bucky. Thanks for sharing. So Super Captain chimes in again. It says, the truth is, I never really got into Daredevil, and I'm not a big Frank Miller fan as he cast quite a shadow over the character when I was really getting into comics. In recent years, though, multiple great reviews convinced me to check out Mark Waid's run, and I'm so glad that I did. He and Chris Samnee's definitely created some fantastic comics. The Charles Soule issues were pretty good, too. The funny thing is that Matt Murdock frequently tops the list of comic book characters and superheroes of faith, and I am a professional clergy person, so I always felt like I should dig deeper into Daredevil. Perhaps this will give me some inspiration. Ah. Well, Super Captain, I hope it does, and I hope you enjoy what you find in the Daredevil world. They were from my buddy Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcasting Network. He's also my co-pilot on the Blue Devil episodes of Once Upon a Geek. Frank, as usual, writes, you know, a giant book of things, but I'm just going to pick some pieces here. He says, I have no memory of seeing the Daredevil comic on the newsstand until at least the Denny O'Neill, Klaus Janson years. My first proper issue was the Improper Assistant Editor's Month, Daredevil number 202. And I learned about his Billy Cub in issue of Ohotmu, Volume 1. It took until 1986 before I started reading him with any regularity during the Ann Nesenti run. I got a good education in Marvel Saga, which were kind of his Lee and Everett origin with lots of Frank Miller details added. I was still a Spider-Man reader, so when I wasn't getting a taste for Matt in his own series, he was still turning up in arcs like The Death of Jean DeWolf and Gang War. Then he says, one of the bit of merch I didn't notice that you said I still have is TSR's one-on-one Marvel Superheroes Adventure game books, Daredevil versus Kingpin. I think I bought the two-book set in a slipcase from Circus World Toy Store rather than Walden Books or B. Dalton, so it's probably at a deep discount. All right, pulling back the curtain a little bit, folks. I didn't have to read that part of the comment, but there's no way I was going to miss an opportunity to say Circus World, Walden Books, and B. Dalton all in the same sentence. It's just, there's no way I could pass that up. I think Frank knew that, and he baited me, so I fell for it. All right, back to what Frank says. He says, anyway, one player would be Daredevil and the other would be Kingpin. Each player got a heavily illustrated choose-your-own-adventure style branching narrative book, but also the books would collide at various points. Rather than getting to make a choice, the players would engage in combat using dice and a combat table on the back of each book. The narrative would then advance in individual books based on who won each of the three rounds or phase when the books intersected. Dang, Frank, that sounds so freaking cool. He says he only played it once, but man, I would have loved to have played that with a buddy. That sounds amazing. And then Frank says, I'm available if you ever want to dive deeper into your typhoid kink. I got into her when Steve Lytle started doing the art on her reoccurring Marvel Comics Presents appearances. You know, Frank, I bought those when they were coming out because it had Typhoid Mary, and I can't remember anything about the story at all. I may need to dig back in those. I don't remember if they're any good or not. I should check them out, I suppose. Then we'll hear from Alexander Osias, who says, I was trying to trace my Daredevil interests and decided to go and find out which covers look familiar. He says, growing up in the Philippines, the sources of comics in the 70s were A, comics that found their way in through American forces through the U.S. bases at the time, B, informally imported comics, or C, strange reprints by national bookstore which had none of the ads but all the comics. I'm fairly certain that my first encounter came from option C, for Daredevil issues 130 through 134. All the covers are shockingly familiar to me because I probably read them multiple times at the Green Rose barbershop where I had my haircut. They used to get those reprint comics and have them ready for kids to read while having the haircut. This was my first exposure to Daredevil, a mix of action and adventure, melodrama, and mystery. He fell off my radar during that time, and I missed the entire Elektra arc, only to be hooked once more by the stunning cover to Saved, issue 231. From there, I had already found a regular source of comics and was able to collect back issues and the rest of the Born Again storyline before dropping off Daredevil again. Restarting my collection with the Fall from Grace storyline and then ended around the time he ditched the red and gray outfit. I'm not sure why I've been off and on with Daredevil. I think I do like the character, but I probably subconsciously find reasons to stop when a particular storyline or character arc is ended, but keep checking in to see if the current one is a bit more to my taste. Hey, Alex, you know, that makes perfect sense. Everyone's got their way of navigating characters. There's lots of characters I drop in and out. X-Men, for example. X-Men I drop in and out of all the time, so I totally get where you're coming from. All right, we heard from Chris Pine again. It says, I really enjoyed this conversation. At some point, Dee Dee became my favorite character, overtaking Spider-Man. Like you both pointed out, Matt was definitely the more flawed on a personal level. Matt seemed to want to right the wrongs of his childhood, growing up in a poor neighborhood among people the system forgot about, seeing what broken homes and abuse can do to kids as they grow up in troubled teens. But he was also in denial about his own upbringing, and I think he believes that he escaped that world, but everything he does is connected to it. And without it confronting the trauma in a healthy way, he's always going to crash and burn in his personal life. Wow, that's some deep thoughts there, Chris, that you may be onto something about the reoccurring cyclical nature of self-destructiveness with Matt. He says, as far as the story arc, I always come back to Born Again. It's one of those perfect comics. Everything works, but Mazzucchelli's art is probably why I love it so much. The pacing, the cinematic nature of the storytelling, even now, those panels where Matt is fighting on the roof and Karen is running in the alley, it gets the hair on the back of my neck standing up every time I read it. You know, Chris, I actually just reread Born Again last week at the time of this recording, and it is so stinking good. I don't think I read it in like 10 years. It was just gorgeous to go through it again. Actually, and And this is pulling back the curtain a little bit, and a little special reward for those of you still paying attention. Myself and J. David Weir both reread Born Again so that we could record about it on a podcast with our buddy Billy on the Magazines and Monsters podcast. So keep your eyes peeled. I'm not sure. I think maybe May sometime you'll hear a Magazines and Monsters podcast, an episode on Born Again with me and J. David Weir. And we had so much fun talking about that book. But don't you dare tell anyone you heard it from me, okay? All right, moving on. Then we heard from David Young, who says, I started reading and collecting comics in late 1981 or early 1982, so it would have been around the end of the first Frank Miller run. I clearly remember having issue 182, which was the issue with the cover of Matt hugging Elektra's tombstone. I also remember quite strongly having the Spider-Man and Daredevil Special Edition one-shot from 1984, reprinting Miller's two issues of Peter Parker the Spectacular Spider-Man, guest-starring Daredevil, in the four-issue Elektra Saga miniseries. I ended up picking up Daredevil from 1982 all the way through 2011 or so when I stopped buying Everything Comics, which was the start of my nine-year hiatus from comics. He says, I also found your story of fearing that the visiting reverend would somehow know your hidden issue of Daredevil quite entertaining. I couldn't help but wonder how much worse your anxiety would have been if it was an issue of Son of Satan. Being raised in a Christian home, I still remember the conflicting feelings I had about the issue of Marvel Team-Up featuring the Human Torch and Son of Satan. David, that's awesome. I appreciate you sharing that. I'm glad I'm not the only one who was worried about those kinds of situations. And then finally, Captain Entropy chimed in and says, I really enjoyed this episode and Frank's on the same topic. I should probably reread my Daredevil comics. Yeah, you absolutely should, Captain Entropy. Please do. Now, folks, again, my thank you to all of you for your support of the Once Upon a Geek podcast. You guys are absolutely amazing. You took the time to leave your feedback and share with us, and I sincerely appreciate it. Now, if you'd like to be included in the next feedback section, all you need to do is leave a comment on our website for one of the next few episodes. And remember, that's fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. We'll cover feedback again in another five episodes from now. And that includes feedback on this episode about Detective Jim. So please keep those cards and letters coming, folks. And thank you to all of my co-hosts for the past few episodes. They were simply wonderful. And thanks to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll check in with this episode's guest, Doug, to finish up monkeying around.
Chick, chick, why? What brick?
Siskoid watches a lot of movies. Like, a lot. So now he has his own movie podcast. Or several. Siskoid Cinema is your one-stop umbrella for a variety of shows like Fade In, exploring the first films of famous actors and directors.
This is a joke, right?
On Borrowed Time, discussing all your favorite time travel movies.
Whoa, this is heavy.
Why are things so heavy in the future? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational pull?
And No Escape from Kurt Russell, a dissection of the man, the mystique, and the movies.
There goes a perfectly good bumper sticker.
And more. Siskoid Cinema, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Chick, chick, why? What brick?
Doug, thank you so much again for appearing on the show and sharing your love of Detective Chimp. This was a blast.
It absolutely was, Shag. Thank you so much for having me join you here on this one.
Well, and I'm glad to finally get you on Once Upon a Geek. You know, we've been working together on stuff for 15 years, and a lot of it was my old blog, Once Upon a Geek, crossing over with you. So now you're on the podcast, so it's come full circle, sir.
Amen.
So why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet besides your Old Thune Red Tornado blog?
If you find the Old Thune Red Tornado blog, you're in for a wonderful disappointment in how recently it's been updated. I can be found on pretty much, I'm just on Blue Sky at this point, and that's my last name, Zavisha, and I'll spell that out, and I'll use Zeds for Mark Gray out there. So it's ZAWISZA.bsky.social. So that's me on Blue Sky. And also, I do occasionally write for Back Issue Magazine. So I know I've got something coming up. I don't know if it's been announced as far as the theme goes, but it's not too far afield from maybe another podcast that you're known for, Mr. Shag.
Interesting. All right. Yeah. Well, that sounds very exciting. I can't wait to find out more. And now Doug's selling himself short, folks. Also, Doug has an incredible back catalog of stuff he's read. If you've read any comic review website, I'm sure you've read reviews by Doug over the years. The Hawkman Companion from Tomorrow's. I mean, sir, you are quite prolific. And I realize you were just talking about what you're doing today, but you have an amazing amount of things out there people can enjoy.
Far far too kind, Shag.
Well, I appreciate you being here again, Doug, and thank you so much.
Thank you, man.
And folks, remember, be sure to check out all of our podcasting partners this month that are covering ape-related comics all through April 2024. The easiest way is to look for the hashtag JLApril2024 on social media. Quit monkeying around and listen already, people. Now, come back next time when we cover another topic that brings us joy. And what will that topic be? Sorry, folks, you'll just have to wait and find out on the next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Doug.
And remember, life is short. Focus on the positive.
Find your joy.